This is a true crime in real time update from the On Deadline podcast. We bring you the latest developing crime stories and true crime updates from our newsrooms across the nation. This week, we have brief updates on two disturbing cases out of the Philadelphia area. We've also got information about a reward offered for a shooting at a historic restaurant in New Orleans, as well as a discussion of a neighbor-on-neighbor shooting in Missouri, the latest on a man accused of killing a Detroit neurosurgeon, and an interview with the lawyer representing Renee Good's family in the wake of her fatal shooting by an ICE agent. It's a lot to get to, so we'll dive right in with these reports out of KYW News Radio in Philadelphia. One is about a murder that allegedly occurred within the walls of a prison cell.
An inmate at SCI Phoenix is on trial in Montgomery County for first-degree murder, accused of beating and choking his cellmate to death. KYW Suburban Bureau Chief Jim Melwort reports.
Prosecutor Gabrielle Hughes points to video from SCI Phoenix that shows 41-year-old Nathan Bloss and 45-year-old Sean Harden were the only two men in the cell on the night of October 31st, 2024. The next morning, Harden was found dead on the floor of the cell, partially covered by a bedsheet. Hughes says Bloss told corrections officers he found Harden that way, but she says the autopsy finds hemorrhaging on Harden's neck and bruises all over his body, similar to what she calls a beatdown. Hughes says Bloss never notified guards, despite each cell being equipped with an emergency button. And she says the officer who handled Harden's intake at SCI Phoenix earlier in the day noted no significant injuries. But defense attorney Scott Frame says Harden had to be airlifted from a Western PA prison with internal bleeding in his chest from a beating 27 days earlier. But detectives didn't get his medical records from the time between that beating and his death. Harden was nearing the end of a 4 to 8 year sentence for molesting three children. Bloss is serving 3.5 to 7 years for firearms violations and assaulting a police officer.
A little over a year ago, an emaciated 12-year-old girl died in the Philadelphia area. And just this month, her own father appeared in court to face several charges related to her death, including first-degree murder. Here's KYW's Nigel Thompson with the details.
In a two-hour court appearance Friday, 54-year-old Rendell Hoagland pleaded guilty to first-degree murder, conspiracy, kidnapping, and other charges in connection with the murder of his 12-year-old daughter, Melinda, in 2024. Melinda died in surgery at Paoli Hospital on the night of May 4th, 2024, just before 10 p.m. Her dad, Rendell, had called 911 earlier in the day and told authorities that the girl had struck a tree while riding her bike in the early hours of the morning. But the Chester County District Attorney's Office says the numerous injuries all over Melinda's body observed by medics on the scene and staff at the hospital, along with her severe emaciation, told a different story. Investigators later uncovered that Melinda had lost consciousness earlier in the day and didn't get help for hours. An autopsy revealed she died of starvation and multiple blunt force injuries. She also weighed only 50 pounds when she died. Hoagland was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. His wife, Cindy Warren, will go to trial on June 8th of this year in connection with Melinda's death. Three of Melinda's half-sisters have also filed lawsuits against Chester County, the state, a number of schools, and service organizations for not doing enough to stop the abuse Melinda faced.
If you visited the historic Dookie Chase restaurant in New Orleans, Louisiana this Tuesday, you would have seen a priest walking around the building, as well as an armed security guard standing outside the entrance. That's because the 85-year-old culinary destination was being blessed after a fatal shooting that left one 19-year-old dead and tourists injured. While diners have returned to the halls of Dookie Chase, authorities and the local Crime Stoppers group are still on the lookout for the gunman. In fact, there's a cash reward being offered to help catch the shooter. WWL's Tommy Tucker has more.
Darlene Costanza joins us, president and CEO of Crime Stoppers. I mean, you know, I hate to even call this a Dookie Chase shooting because they had nothing to do with this at all. Somebody read the victim, Kareem Harris, if I got that name right, I think I do, 21 years old, ran into the restaurant to avoid getting shot. Then they followed him in there and shot four people and all, killed him, wounded three people from out of town. Tell me what Crime Stoppers, tell me what kind of award is available, and then we'll talk, reward is available, and then we'll talk about what Crime Stoppers does and how it works.
Sure. So, I mean, immediately we knew with this that we wanted to increase our reward, and we have policies that we follow. So for this, we increased our reward to up to $5,000. But we also knew, Tommy, that, you know, the $5,000 was great, but we knew that people were going to step up and assist. And I really want to thank the business community. We had immediately calls from the New Orleans Business Council and River Region. We had the Louisiana Restaurant Association, members of the business council. Then, of course, we also had Liberty Bank join with us. So actually, yesterday, we announced the increased reward is now $13,500. And, you know, it's always important to remind folks it's a cash reward. And you're going to call and remain anonymous when you're using the Crime Stoppers program. So really, there's no fear for anybody in that community that might have the information about that shooter. You know, they can feel free to come forward, and hopefully it'll lead to that arrest. It has to lead to an arrest, obviously, to collect the reward through Crime Stoppers.
And you getting some action so far, Darlene?
We are getting some action. Obviously, we need more. I mean, there was video footage, and, of course, the gentleman had a hoodie, from what we've been told.
He was no gentleman. I hate to say that, but he was no gentleman.
Right.
He was a killer.
The shooter had a hoodie on, but I know that NOPD has some footage. And we are getting information. We're getting people, persons of interest that I know that's being investigated. But, you know, we need that piece of information to close the case. So we're hoping today, with this increased incentive, that people are going to come forward with more information.
Thank you, Darlene. How does somebody do that if they have information?
They can get in touch with us either through calling. They know the number, 504-822-1111. You can go to the Crime Stoppers GNO website, and there's at the very top it says submit a tip. You can upload an attachment to video or social media feeds, which we do get a lot of that. Or you can do the app, which is Crime Stoppers GNO, Say It Here, mobile app. Everything is anonymous. And, Tommy, I do want to add that we are also helping in the arson case in the Bywater.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, if you are involved with that or
right.
not.
Yes, we are absolutely working with the fire department. We've gotten a lot of tips on it so far. Thank you to all of you in those areas that are sending us, you know, footage and the tips. But we do have a reward available in that. We're actually announcing a $5,000 cash reward for the arson. So anybody, again, contact Crime Stoppers. It's safe. You know we've been around. It's a place that you can help law enforcement.
Darlene, I've been here all my life, as have you. I don't remember anything like that happening at all. Do you, ever?
No. That is very alarming to me. My father was a fireman. He actually worked arson cases. Mm-hmm. So for me, yeah, I think this is, everybody, let's get this person. I know this footage, but let's do it quickly.
Yeah, amen.
That's right.
In Kansas City, Missouri, the Dana and Parks podcast out of KMBZ has been following the case of a man who was accused of killing his neighbor in the street right outside their houses this month. According to reports, 42-year-old Jeffrey Travis King got into a confrontation with his 41-year-old neighbor, Christopher Cole Wells, a married father of four, outside their homes. After the confrontation, Wells' body was found on the ground, face down, with five bullet holes in it. The Kansas City Star reported that his other neighbors say King's alleged attack of Wells is the culmination of harassment and verbal abuse that's gone on for years. They say that King has frequently fought with people who complain about him keeping dilapidated cars in the neighborhood. Now, King's attorney has said that his client may pursue a, quote, stand your ground defense. And the Dana and Parks team have thoughts on this.
The Kansas City man accused of killing his neighbor in the street in broad daylight will seek a stand your ground defense.
Okay. Like stand over the ground and shoot my neighbor in the back eight more times?
Correct.
Got it. Allegedly?
You know how much I hate these stand your ground laws and some states' interpretation of those laws. You know, recklessly loose interpretation. Oh, I felt fear, so I did what I did, right? Most sane people would have to agree that a stand your ground law with a lot of this shooting caught on tape, witnesses, including two kids who were walking to school, by the way, I think a lot of people would agree that there's no way this applies here. But here's the story. Jeffrey Travis King, the Kansas City man accused of shooting his neighbor to death in the street outside of his house earlier this month, may seek a stand your ground defense, his attorney suggested last night.
Okay.
It is, quoting here from the attorney, it is very important for people to acknowledge and respect that Mr. King, at least according to the probable cause statement, this is a law enforcement affidavit, it states that, quote, Mr. King was ambushed at his home. And the state of Missouri, he says, has a very robust self-defense protection, stand your ground state. Quoting there from Matthew T. Merriam with the Bates and Merriman law firm. The case, which has yet to be scheduled for trial, involves King, who does have a black eye.
He was punched in the eye.
Age 42.
In his left eye.
Who around 7:30 in the morning on January 12th got into an outdoor confrontation with his neighbor, Christopher Cole Wells, 41, who lived three houses away and was shot and killed in the street. We know that.
I thought Christopher Wells lived right next door.
I think it's saying three doors down.
Three doors down. Okay.
The fight that ensued, according to the police probable cause statement, ended with Wells, a married father of four, being shot at close range and dying in the middle of the street, lying face down with five bullet holes in the front of his body, eight in his back.
Pause for a second.
Yep.
I thought he was ambushed at his house.
We're going to get to that, Sam.
Do you live in the street?
We are going to get to that. King is now charged with first-degree murder and armed criminal action and has pleaded not guilty. And we talked about this. Wells' funeral was held yesterday, the same day as his bond hearing, the neighbor's bond hearing. Okay? So let me scroll down to the new information about what happened the day Chris Wells was killed. The tension erupted January 12th when, according to the probable cause statement, Wells' wife Kristen was walking her dog and she saw a vehicle running on King's property. The Wellses had earlier filed an order of protection against King. So Wells returned to the home when she noticed him walking toward her in her house with a blanket. As King walked toward the property, he tossed the blanket into the grass area of the front yard. We know this.
Why?
Because he's an idiot. She then calls her husband because they've got a no contact order and says he's at it again. He just threw something into our yard.
An overt escalation.
This is so important. King was not at home at the moment when Chris Wells shows up.
And he had returned from work. He had been at work at 7:30.
Correct. 7:30 the statement reads, surveillance video from a neighbor's camera shows Wells, the victim, sitting on a curb across the street from King's residence. I want to be clear. Chris Wells was never on King's property.
Smart play.
He was sitting across the street. Mm-hmm. King, the statement reads, then pulled up to the front of his house in his car and got out. In our mind's eye, Scott, we thought King was home.
And that Wells had knocked on the door
and said,
hey, man, what's going on? Why are you throwing something in my yard?
Chris Wells, the victim, is across the street sitting on the curb. King approaches him in his car. King gets out of his car.
Presumably armed with a handgun.
Yep, there is a restraining order, a no contact order between King and Wells against King. He pulls up his car and then gets out of his car. So already there, he's in violation of that no contact order.
Well, okay. And now we know that Wells did not approach him, that he approached Wells. What ground are you standing, sir?
This is the next.
Great point,
the next
Sam.
Two lines are very important to that very, very fact, Sam. The statement reads that the video shows Wells goes toward King and throws a punch that appeared to strike King on the head. Wells did throw a punch.
That is without refute.
The momentum of King and the victim then carries each of them to the rear of the vehicle where the camera's view is blocked. King reemerges, followed closely by the victim. And soon after, Wells is seen backing away, apparently raising his hands in the air as he backs away.
Presumably because King has now drawn a weapon.
Eight gunshots are then heard as the view of them once again is blocked by the vehicle. So what you see on the camera is Wells, hands up. Obviously, he sees the gun and is going, whoa, 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 whoa. Crazy. Mm-hmm. Starts backing up. Eight shots ring out. In what world?
Actually, 13 ended up
ringing out. Where you have gotten out of your car to approach someone who has a no contact order against you. Mm-hmm. Whether they throw a punch at you or not. In what world, when they are backing away with their hands up,
Is it legal
to put 13 bullets in that person's body?
It's not legal, quite frankly. And I think the attorney And they're doing what attorneys have to do, trying to defend their client. Although, dare I say, this attorney has no shame. If the victim in this crime has his hands up and is backing away, there is no threat. There no longer is a Castle Doctrine argument to be made. There is no self-defense argument to be made.
Even if there was, Scott, it's a gun versus a fist.
You're backing away with your hands up.
By the way, Matthew Merriman of Bates and Merriman Law is the same Matthew Merriman of the same Bates and Merriman Law who defended Chief Sahalik, if you remember those.
Yes. I do. And listen, everyone deserves a robust defense. This, obviously, from the second this happened, we said that this fool is going to try to say he was in fear of his life.
Yep.
The juvenile witnesses, by the way, the two kids walking to school who, God bless those kids, had to watch all of this. The juvenile witnesses state they observed King then shoot the victim in the back as the victim was lying face down on the ground.
There's no defense. And I'm with you, Dana. I think everybody deserves a defense. There's no doubt about it. There is no defense. You shot a man, allegedly, 8 times in the back after you had shot him 5 times in the front.
Missouri's statute for use of force in defense of person states, a person may use physical force on another if they reasonably believe such force is necessary to defend themselves or another from what they reasonably believe to be the use of imminent unlawful force by such other person. However, there are caveats, including, quote, when the actor was the initial aggressor or when he or she has withdrawn from the encounter and effectively communicated such withdrawal to such other person.
I would argue hands up and walking backwards is withdrawing from the encounter. There is no defense.
This April will mark the 3rd anniversary of the death of Detroit neurosurgeon Dr. Devin Hoover. His alleged killer recently entered a guilty plea during jury selection for his trial. WWJ's John Hewitt reported that the alleged killer
will serve at least 40 to 60 years in a fascinating turnabout here in court today. On a second day of jury selection in his murder trial, 35-year-old Desmond Burks decided to take a plea deal from Wayne County prosecutors in connection with the murder of Detroit neurosurgeon Devon Hoover from a murder April of 2023, going on 3 years now. Outside of court just now, moments ago, his attorney Gabby Silver describes the decision.
So Mr. Burks was facing a mandatory 25 years because he was charged as a violent habitual fourth offender. So this was near, you know, this was a mid-guideline range sentence on a murder two. And given that he would have had to do 25 years under any circumstance, you know, we thought that this was a good offer.
Did you have some good defenses in this case?
Anything else?
You said it was.
We certainly, it was a circumstantial case for sure. And, I mean, you know, it was a circumstantial case. There was no direct evidence. And we were prepared to do our job if that was what happened. But ultimately today, Mr. Burks decided to take the plea, and that's where we ended up.
Burks also pleading guilty to a separate charge of manslaughter for fatally punching a man during a road rage incident in April of 2024, a year after Hoover's murder. That man, Rita Salah, was killed after that incident. So now, again, it looks like it will be a minimum of 40 years, again, as opposed to going to trial on second-degree murder. Formal sentencing scheduled for February 20th. But Tracy and Tony, we're going to sift through the audio here with defense counsel Gabby Silver and have more details for you later. But that is literally the news from moments ago outside of circuit court here in Detroit.
We'll end this episode today with what will probably remain one of the most shocking shooting cases to make headlines this year, even though it's only January. The shooting of 37-year-old mother Renee Good at the hands of an ICE agent in Minneapolis. Antonio Romanucci, the attorney representing Renee Good's family, joined the Adam and Jordana show out of WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities this week to discuss some of the latest developments in the case, including the results of an autopsy.
Yeah, you commissioned this independent autopsy. Tell us what it reveals.
Well, what it reveals is, I think, very telling. We know that there are at least three clear path gunshot wounds. Whether or not there is a fourth or not really depends upon a thorough inspection of the vehicle. We need to see if there are any bullets or fragments in the car that would indicate that there's a fourth. But the two of the three that are clear, we know that they were non-life-threatening injuries, ones that one could have, you know, recovered from had there been such a fact. But the one shot that we know that was devastating was the one to the side of the head, which entered Renee right above the left ear.
Does this change anything, the way you are prosecuting? Does this, I mean, we all saw the video. We all know what happened. Does this change anything in your case?
Well, look, it's a very substantial finding. Does it change anything from our initial impressions of the video? I would say no to that, because the video evidence is, in my opinion, it's pretty clear. We know what happened based on the video. There's certainly, we need to consider the totality of circumstances. We don't want to exclude any particular evidence, and that includes reasonable police practices. And I don't know that Ross exercised reasonable police practices during this encounter. So when you look at the totality of it, you know, I don't want to, you know, reach a judgment or render a verdict now. I don't want to get caught in the same trap that many other people did and label and say what happened. All I can say is that this autopsy was a substantial finding. It's going to, I think it's going to bolster our theories on the case of what we feel happened, and be able to show that the federal government is indeed liable for this horrific event.
What access do you have to other evidence, if at all?
Well, you know, without revealing too much, I mean, we would have access to evidence that is not in the control of other people or entities. So that's a fancy way of saying that whatever is out there that we can grab or get a hold of or talk to or photograph, we will. But if it's in somebody's, you know, warehouse or garage, not in our control or we have access to, you know, we're going to struggle to get to it until there's an agreement.
Like the vehicle, like you've had no access to the vehicle at all.
Exactly. I mean, obviously that vehicle is the most obvious piece of evidence, as is Jonathan Ross's pistol. You know, those are two key pieces of evidence, and we clearly do not have any access to them or control, but we would like both of them.
Sir, we understand there's still, as I think as of this morning, please correct me if I'm wrong, no investigation into Jonathan Ross and the shooting, no federal investigation into the shooting of Renee Good. What is your case like? Are you suing? What are you suing for? Tell us about charges, if any, that you are bringing and against whom.
Sure. So, yeah, you are correct. As of now, we have heard nothing different than what we've heard since the beginning, that there's no investigation. We haven't heard anything differently than anyone else. So what we are doing is we have to conduct a reasonable, good faith, factual-based investigation so that we can bring forth the process to eventually sue the federal government. It's not a regular process. It's not like, okay, I'm going to hire a lawyer, file a lawsuit. It's not that easy here. We have to go through a much more archaic process. We have to file first what's called a federal tort claim. We have to wait for the government to respond to it or not respond to it. That will take some time. After that, then we have to, then we have the time to file a lawsuit against the government in federal court in Minneapolis, which would be heard solely by a judge, not by a jury.
Last week, Joe Thompson, who is the interim U.S. attorney here in Minnesota, resigned, reportedly, because he was pressured to look into Good's partner. Have you been able to document any investigations by the federal government into any of your clients?
I have not heard anything, seen anything, and I, quite frankly, don't know that I would expect anything. So I don't know of any whatsoever.
Your family, of course, is representing, or excuse me, your law firm is representing the family of Renee Good. How are they? What is, how is her wife, her children? Can you give us an update on her family?
I can. I mean, they are still in a very much of a mourning phase. They're devastated. They really feel like somebody that was so, you know, and her last name means so much, that was so good to them, you know, that was so good in their lives, was taken away just unnecessarily without any basis whatsoever. They feel terrible. They're still processing. And they I don't know if and when they'll ever have closure.
Back to the autopsy and the shots. And again, we want to wait to hear what this investigation says. But the shot that you describe as the devastating shot, the one in the head. I mean, from what you assess with the autopsy and the numerous amounts of videos out there, would that shot have been from when Jonathan Ross was on the side of the vehicle as the car was passing him?
So here, I mean, now you've got me speaking as to my opinion, as opposed to science and biomechanical engineering and forensics. So, you know, what we do know is this, and I think you ask a fair question. The first shot we know went through the lower left, the lower right windshield that we saw in video. So we know that first shot went there. The next two shots appear to be taken from the side of the vehicle with the window rolled down. We think the window was rolled down. We need to confirm that. That would be great to see, you know, with the vehicle inspection. So if those next two shots were taken where we think they were, then Jonathan Ross shot his gun at Renee while he was on the side of the vehicle as she was moving away from him. And that is very significant.
Another question in regards to the evidence you're trying to gather, does it involve also apparent lack of aid that was given to Renee in the moments after the shooting? We've heard the story about the man who was on the scene who said he was a doctor who was told to get away. What role is response of aid playing into what you're looking into?
Well, we're not going to exclude anything at all here. And that, you know, we don't know everything about how devastating that shot to the head was. I mean, I think that's something that we have to investigate further. I don't know that it's that simple, but we will not exclude anything in our pursuit for justice and what we think is this extreme and excessive deadly force issue.
Do you know anything about Jonathan Ross? We heard that he was taken to, you know, there are reports that he was taken to the hospital. There was even a report that he had some kind of internal injuries. Do you know if there's any truth to any of that?
Well, I think that's a very fair question. You know, we've heard, I think I've heard the same as you, that he suffered from internal bleeding. Okay. Well, you know, we're trying to be the voice of truth and transparency in discussing some of the medical issues that Renee underwent. Mm-hmm. We should also have that same transparency with Jonathan Ross. Was this a bruise? Was it a hemorrhage? What was it? Was it an open skin wound? I saw Jonathan Ross walking after the incident. I did not detect, you know, a limp or some sort of bleeding or other injury. But then again, what do we know unless somebody is transparent with us and tells us what internal bleeding is? It could have been a minor bruise. Well, and who knows? Was it caused by Renee's car? That's even more important. There's internal bleeding, but nobody is tying it up to causation yet.
So how hard do you think it's going to be? I know you're asking for transparency. We'd all like transparency. We all want to know those answers. How hard do you think it's going to be to actually bring a case because of immunities that he had in his role because the fact that you're not going to probably get cooperation from the federal government, at least the way it seems now. How hard do you think it's going to be to bring charges?
Well, I think the answer to that question is I think it will be more challenging. We will have to fight harder, which is something that we're used to. But this is not in any way, shape, or form an impossible task. We will be able to bring our claims and file a lawsuit based on our investigation. I am extremely confident for that.
Last question. I know we promised to let you go here, but are you looking at all into the city or the states, any sort of culpability on their part about having protection in place for protesters? I'm just curious as to the scope of what you're looking into.
No, right now our focus remains on the event itself on January 7th. Our focus is on what happened, the encounter between, you know, the ICE agents and in particular Jonathan Ross and the encounter with Renee. That's what we're focused on.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime in Real Time Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WWL Radio in New Orleans, the Dana and Parks podcast out of KMBZ in Kansas City, WWJ News Radio in Detroit, and the Adam and Jordana Show out of WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. You can find these stations and shows on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. To get these true crime roundups, you can subscribe to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast.